Well, hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. A day late this week, but not a dollar short. As per usual, I'll be reading to you this week from my 2005 novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. It was a bit of a hectic weekend, and yesterday was kind of a write-off because we had the worst snow in London we've had in 20 years. So instead of going into the office and recording a podcast, my wife and I took the baby along with my family to a nice place where we could hang around indoors and be warm and drink coffee. That was partly choice, but partly necessity. The daycare was also shut. But I managed to be pretty productive nevertheless and got a new article written and some other work done. Today I speak to you from the land of Inbox Zero. That's right, there's nothing in my email inbox. It's all taken care of. So if you're expecting an email from me, it probably went into my spam filter. All right, so as I mentioned last week, I spent the weekend at Disneyland Paris with my wife and my daughter, who turned one today, and my parents and my brother and sister-in-law and their little boy all come over for the trip, and it was lovely, although unbelievably cold. Oh my God, it was so cold. And I thought that I still owned winter clothes, being a good hardy Canadian. My clothes are not winter clothes. My clothes are autumn clothes that you can wear in the autumn-like winter of London, modulo the worst snowstorm in 20 years. So we spent the whole 3 days just unbelievably cold. But apart from that, had a lovely time, and the baby loved it, every minute of it. So I've got a reprieve. I'm back in London for a week. And then, unfortunately, I hit the road again. I do like going places, but I also like staying put. I'm going to be off to New York on Saturday, to go to the O'Reilly Tools of Change conference, where I'm delivering one of the morning keynotes. And I'll be talking about DRM and the record industry and the book industry and the differences and the similarities and the risks they face. It should be a provocative talk. And I've confirmed a couple other speaking engagements in case any of you are in these places and want to come out and see me. There's an event in Prince Edward Island in my native land of Canada on the 30th of September and the 1st of October that I'll be speaking at. And also the White Pines Ontario Library Association Award events in Toronto at Harbourfront on the 13th of May. Very exciting to have a couple of confirmed gigs back in the land of my birth, especially the one in May. Nice to go see the old family and friends. I speak to you from the land of new technology as well. For the last week, I've been running a very, very nice new laptop from a company I'd never heard of before called System 76. A little background on this. About 3 years ago now, I switched from running macOS for many, many years to running Linux. And I figured, well, if I'm not running macOS, why shell out for Mac hardware? It's more expensive, there's fewer choices. So I switched to ThinkPads, which I really liked. I have to say that the ThinkPads, especially the small light ones, are great little machines. Super rugged, waterproof keyboards, great worldwide service. You know, you pay an extra $100 a year and a man shows up at your door the day after you have a breakdown and fixes your computer. I've had, you know, a little problems here and there from them. I once had a machine that went through six motherboards, but for the most part, these have been damn good machines. But the problem with them is that they are full of components for which there are no or substandard open source free software drivers. So just stuff just didn't work the way that I wanted it to. And there was always tweaking to do, especially when I upgraded the OS. So the video didn't quite do what I wanted to do. Sleep didn't just work the way I wanted it to. It didn't just work. I spent a lot of time doing what I didn't want to do, which was Googling for solutions to stupid niggly problems, workarounds that really represented the fact that a lot of the software was just unpatchable because the drivers were not, they weren't open source drivers. They were proprietary. So System 76, they buy blank books, I think from Acer, and they source components for which they're open source drivers. And the differences between these components seem to be negligible, right? It's, you know, you can either get one model of Intel video card or another. You can either get one model of network card or another. Just some of them really work and some of them really don't. So they just put the ones that just work in, and they're cheap as anything, $750 for the beginner model of their subcompact light darter notebook. It's a little heavier than the ThinkPad, and that I regret. With a big 9-cell battery, this thing's a little over 4 pounds. And there are a few hardware things, or rather design things, that just aren't as nice as the ThinkPads, which wouldn't win any awards for design anyway. But for example, there's the CD or DVD drive. It's nice to have one of those again. None of the ThinkPads I've been carrying around for the last couple of years have them. They lighten the load by leaving those off. But the CD drive, the release is right there on the side of the machine where my hand rests whenever I pick it up or even adjust it on my lap. So I'm always opening up the CD drive and having to click it shut again, which is really starting to get on my nerves. And the keyboard just isn't what I'd hoped for. They shaved down some of the punctuation keys down in the bottom right corner to fit it all on the chassis. And there's none of those extended cursor keys like home and delete and page up and page down that really make a huge difference for me on the ThinkPad keys. I never use them being a Mac person, but boy, have I ever gotten accustomed to them now, and I really miss them. Now that said, holy moly, does this machine just work and work like stink. So you take it out of the box. It's got Intrepid Ibix, the latest Ubuntu, which I couldn't ever get running on the ThinkPad X61 I'd been working with before. Just works. And Ibix is a great operating system. So I've got a little 3G dongle from T-Mobile UK. Previously, I'd run some really crummy open source software for it called the Vodafone 3G dongle driver or something. This time, I plugged in the dongle, and the OS said, "You appear to have plugged in a dongle for a 3G modem. Are you in the UK? Yes, no." I click yes, and it says, "Here are the providers I know about in the UK. Are you using T-Mobile?" And I clicked yes, and it said, "There you go. You're done. No configuration, no tech support calls. Just works. Just works. Everything just works. Plugging new drives in, just works. Getting it on the internet, just works. Getting the encrypted partition running, just works. All of it just works. Holy moly, do I love this operating system. And does it ever work well?" And the machine, all told, was not bad. It was about $1,400, including overnight shipping, 4 gigs of RAM, 500 gig hard drive. I'm again able to carry around everything now, all the video, all the audio, everything in one place, one backup solution wherever I go. It's fantastic. And, you know, it's fast. So there you have it. That's my totally uncompensated commercial. Slightly clunky hardware, but boy, does it just work. Pretty light, pretty good. And then the last thing I'll mention, because it's germane to this novel that I'm reading to you, well, actually two things I want to mention. The first is that I just found out that Forbes finally published an article I wrote for them forever ago about my friend Darren Atkinson. The reason that I'm telling you this is that Darren Atkinson is an amazing dumpster diver, and in some ways was the template for a character we are about to meet in Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, called Kurt. I urge you to go read the story. It's called It's Just Garbage. And if you just Google Forbes Dumpster Diver Doctor, I'm sure it'll pop right out. The last thing I want to mention is that For the Win, that my new novel, which I've talked to you about before, is really going well. 21 days in, I am 21,000 words in. I have written 1,000 words every day, no matter what, including travel and the rest of it. And even the days I was away with my daughter for her birthday. And it's going great guns. I'm really happy with how it's working out at this rate. It will be finished in another 79 days or so, because I'm projecting this to be about a 100,000-word novel. All right. Enough of that. You're not here for introductory material. You're here for a novel. I have another 35 minutes before I have to get to pick up my daughter and take her to the ice cream parlor for her ice cream birthday party. And I'm going to devote the next 15 or 20 of it to reading to you. Alan walked past his study, past the tableau of laptop and desk and chair, and felt the pull of the story and kept going, pulling his housecoat tighter around himself. The summer morning was already hotting up, and the air in the house had a sticky, dewy feel. He found Edward sitting on the sofa with the sheets and pillowcases folded neatly next to him. "I set out a couple of towels for you in the second floor bathroom and found an extra toothbrush," Alan said, "if you want them." "Thanks," Edward said, echoing in his empty chest. The thick rolls of his face were contorted in a caricature of sorrow. "Where's Frederick?" Alan asked. "Gone," Edward said, and broke into spasms of sobbing. "He's gone, he's gone, he's gone. I woke up and he was gone." Alan shifted the folded linens to the floor and sat next to Edward. "What happened?" You know what happened, Alan, Edward said. You know as well as I do. Dave took him in the night. He followed us here, and he came in the night, and he stole him away. You don't know that, Alan said, softly stroking Edward's greasy fringe of hair. He could have wandered out for a walk or something. Of course I know it, Edward yelled, his voice booming in the hollow of his great chest. Look! He handed Alan a small, desiccated lump, like a black bean pierced with a paperclip wire. You showed this to me yesterday, Alan said. It's from a different finger, Edward said, and he buried his face in Alan's shoulder, sobbing uncontrollably. Have you looked for him? Alan said. I've been waiting for you to get up. I don't want to go out alone. We'll look together, Alan said. He got a pair of shorts and a t-shirt, shoved his feet into Birkenstocks, and led Edward out the door. The previous night's humidity had thickened to a gray, cloudy soup, swift thunderheads coming in from all sides. The foot traffic was reduced to sparse, fast-moving umbrellas, people rushing for shelter before the deluge. Ozone crackled in the air, and thunder roiled seemingly up from the ground, deep and sickening. They started with a circuit of the house, looking for footprints, body parts. He found a shred of torn gray thrift store shirt caught on a rose bramble near the front of his walk. It smelled of the homey warmth of Edward's innards, and had a few of Frederick's short curly hairs stuck to it. Alan showed it to Edward, then folded it into the change pocket of his wallet. They walked the length of the sidewalk, crossed Wales, and began slowly to cross the little park. Edward circumnavigated the little cement wading pool, tracing the political runes left behind by the market's cheerful anarchist taggers, painfully bent almost double at his enormous waist. What are we looking for, Alan? Footprints, finger bones, clues. Edward puffed back to the bench and sat down, tears streaming down his face. I'm so hungry, he said. Alan, crawling around the torn sod left when someone had dragged one of the picnic tables, contained his frustration. If we can find Daniel, we can get Frederick and George back, okay? All right, Edward snuffled. The next time Alan looked up, Edward had taken off his scuffed shoes and grimy gray socks, rolled up the cuffs of his tent-sized pants, and was wading through the little pool, piggy eyes cast downward. Good idea, Alan called, and turned to the sandbox. A minute later, there was a booming yelp, almost lost in the roll of thunder, and when Alan turned around, Edward was gone. Alan kicked off his Birks and splashed up to the hems of his shorts in the wading pool. At the pool's center, the round fountainhead was a twisted wreck. The concrete crumbled, and the dry steel and brass fixtures contorted and ruptured. They had long streaks of abraded skin, torn shirt, and blood on them, leading down into the guts of the fountain. Cautiously, Alan leaned over, looking well down the dark tunnel that had been scraped out of the concrete centerpiece. The thin gray light showed him the rough walls, chipped out with some kind of sharp tool. "Edward," he called. The voice did not echo or bounce back to him. Tentatively, he reached down the tunnel, bending at the waist over the rough lip of the former fountain. Deep he reached and reached and reached, and as his fingertips hit loose dirt, he leaned farther in and groped blindly, digging his hands into the plug of soil that had been shoveled into the tunnel's bend, a few feet below the surface. He straightened up and climbed in, sinking to the waist, and tried to kick the dirt out of the way, but it wouldn't give. The tunnel had caved in behind the plug of earth. He clambered out, feeling the first fat drops of rain on his bare forearms and the crown of his head. A shovel! There was one in the little coach house in the back of his place, behind the collapsed boxes and the bicycle pump. As he ran across the street, he saw Krishna sitting on his porch, watching him with a hint of a smile. "Lost another one, huh?" he said. He looked as if he'd been awake all night, now hovering on the brink of sleepiness and wiredness. A roll of thunder crashed, and a sheet of rain hurtled out of the sky. Alan never thought of himself as a violent person. Even when he'd had to throw the occasional troublemaker out of his shops, he'd done so with an almost cordial force. Now, though, he trembled and yearned to take Krishna by the throat and ram his head, face first, into the column that held up his front porch, again and again, until his fingers were slick with the blood from Krishna's shattered nose. Alan hurried past him, his shoulders and fists clenched. Krishna chuckled nastily, and Alan thought he knew who got the job of sawing off Mimi's wings when they grew too long, and thought, too, that Krishna must relish the task. "Where are you going?" Krishna called. Alan fumbled with his key ring, desperate to get in and get the keys to the coach house and fetch the shovel before the new tunnels under the park closed. "You're too late, you know," Krishna continued. "You might as well give up. Too late, too late." Alan whirled and shrieked, a wordless contorted war cry, a sound from his bestial guts. As his eyes swam back into focus, he saw Mimi standing beside Krishna, barefoot in a faded housecoat. Her eyes were very wide, and as she turned away from him, he saw that her stubby wings were splayed as wide as they go, forming a tent in her robe that pulled it up over her knees. Alan bit down and clamped his lips together and found his keys. He tracked mud over the polished floors and the ancient, threadbare Persian rugs as he ran to the kitchen, snatching the coach house keys from their hook over the sink. He ran back across the street to the little park, clutching his shovel. He jammed his head into the centerpiece and tried to see which way the tunnel had curved off when it turned, but it was too dark, the dirt too loose. He pulled himself out and took the shovel in his hands like a spear and stabbed it into the concrete bed of the waiting pool, listening for a hollowness and the returning sound like a man thudding for a stud under drywall. The white noise of the rain was too high, the rolling thunder too steady. His chest heaved and his tears mingled with the rain streaking down his face as he stabbed again and again at the pool's bottom. His mind was scrambled and saturated, his vision clouded with the humid mist rising off his exertion-heated chest and the raindrops caught in his eyelashes. He splashed out of the waiting pool and took the shovel to the sod of the park's lawn, picking an arbitrary spot and digging inefficiently and hysterically, the bent shovel tip twisting with each stroke. Suddenly, strong hands were on his shoulders, another set prizing the shovel from his hands. He looked up and blinked his eyes clear, looking into the face of two young Asian police officers. They were bulky from the Kevlar vests they wore under their rain slickers, with kind and exasperated expressions on their face. "Sir," the one holding the shovel said, "what are you doing?" Alan breathed himself into a semblance of composure. "I," he started, then trailed off. Krishna was watching from his porch, grinning ferociously, holding a cordless phone. The creature that had howled at Krishna before scrambled for purchase in Alan's chest. Alan averted his eyes from Krishna's shit-eating 911 calling grin. He focused on the cap of the officer in front of him, shrouded in a clear plastic shower cap to keep its crown dry. "I'm sorry," he said. "It was a dog, a stray, or maybe a runaway, a little Scotty dog. It jumped down the center of the fountain there and disappeared. I looked down and thought that it had found a tunnel that had caved in on it." The officer peered at him from under the brim of his hat, dubiousness writ plain on his young, good-looking face. "A tunnel?" Alan wiped the rain from his eyes, tried to regain his composure, tried to find his charm. It wasn't to be found. Instead, every time he reached for something witty and calming, he saw the streaks of blood and torn clothing, dark on the loose soil of the fountain's center, and no sooner had he dispelled those images than they were replaced with Krishna's sneering, saying, "Lost another one, huh?" He trembled and swallowed a sob. "I think I need to sit down," he said, as calmly as he could, and sank slowly to his knees. The hands on his biceps let him descend. "Sir, do you live nearby?" one of the cops asked, close into his ear. He nodded into his hands, which he'd brought up to cover his face. "Across the street," he said. They helped him to his feet and supported him as he tottered, weak and heaving, to his porch. Krishna was gone once they got there. The cops helped him shuck his drenched shoes and socks and put him down on the overstuffed horsehide sofa. Alan recovered himself with an effort of will and gave them his ID. "I'm sorry, you must think that I'm an absolute lunatic," he said, shivering in his wet clothes. "Sir," the cop who'd taken the shovel from him said, "we see absolute lunatics every day. I think you're just a little upset. We all go a little nuts from time to time." "Yeah," Alan said, "yeah, a little nuts. I had a long night last night. Family problems." The cops shifted their weight, showering the floor with raindrops that beaded on the finish. "Are you going to be all right on your own? We can call someone if you'd like." "No," Alan said, pasting on a weak smile. "No, that's all right. I'll be fine. I'm going to change into some dry clothes and clean up and, oh, I don't know, get some sleep. I think I could use some sleep." "That sounds like an excellent idea," the cop who'd taken the shovel said. He looked around at the bookcases. "You've read all of these?" he asked. "Nah," Alan said, falling into the rote response from his proprietorship of the bookstore. "What's the point of a bunch of books you've already read?" The joke reminded him of better times, and he smiled, a genuine smile. Though the stinging hot shower revived him somewhat, he kept quickening into panic at the thought of David creeping into his house in the night, stumping in on desiccated black child legs, snaggled rictus under mummified lips. He spooked at imagined noises and thudding rain and the dry creaking of the old house as he toweled off and dressed. There was no phone in the mountain, no way to speak to his remaining brothers, the golems, his parents. He balled his fists and stood in the center of his bedroom, shaking with impotent worry. David, none of them had liked David very much. Billy, the fortune teller, had been born with a quiet wisdom, an eerie solemnity that had made him easy for the young Alan to care for. Carlos, the island, had crawled out of their mother's womb and pulled himself to the cave mouth and up the face of their father, lying there for 10 years, accreting until he was ready to push off on his own. But Daniel had been a hateful child from the day he was born. He was colicky, and his screams echoed through their father's caverns. He screamed from the moment he emerged, and Alan tipped him over and toweled him gently dry, and he didn't stop for an entire year. Alan stopped being able to tell day from night, lost track of the weeks and months. He developed a taste for food, real people food, that he'd buy in town at the Loblaw Superstore, but he couldn't leave Davy alone in the cave, and certainly he couldn't carry the howling, shitting, puking, pissing, filthy baby into town with him. So they ate what the golems brought them, sweet grasses, soft berries, frozen winter fruit dug from the base of the orchards in town, blind winter fish from the streams. They drank snowmelt and ate pine cones, and the baby Davy cried and cried until Alan couldn't remember what it was to live in a world of words and conversations and thought and reflections. No one knew what to do about Davy. Their father blew warm winds scented with coal dust and loam to calm him, but still Davy cried. Their mother rocked him on her gentlest spin cycle, but still Davy cried. Alan walked down the slope to Carl's landmass, growing with the dust and rain and snows, and sent him down on the soft grass and earth there, but still Davy cried, and Carlos inched farther and farther toward the St. Lawrence Seaway, sluggishly making his way out to the ocean and as far away from the baby as possible. After his first birthday, David started taking breaks from his screaming, learning to crawl and then totter, becoming a holy terror. If Alan left his schoolbooks within reach of the boy, they'd be reduced to shreds of damp mulch in minutes. By the time he was 2, his head was exactly at Alan's crotch height, and he'd greet his brother on return from school by charging at full speed into Alan's nuts, propelled at unlikely speed on his thin legs. At 3, he took to butchering animals, the rabbits that little Bill kept in stacked hutches outside of the cave mouth went first. Billy rushed home from his grade 2 class, eyes crazed with precognition, and found David methodically wringing the animals' necks and then slicing them open with a bit of sharpened chert. Billy had showed David how to nap flint and chert the week before, after seeing a film strip about it in class. He'd kicked the makeshift knife out of Davy's hands, breaking his thumb with the toe of the hard leather shoes the golem had made for him, and left Davy to bawl in the cave while Billy dignified his pet's corpses, putting their entrails back inside their bodies and wrapping them in shrouds made from old diapers. Alan helped him bury them, and then found Davy and taped his thumb to his hand and spanked him until his arm was too tired to deal out one more wallop. Alan made his way down to the living room, the floor streaked with mud and water. He went into the kitchen and filled a bucket with soapy water and gathered up an armload of rags from the rag bag. Methodically, he cleaned away the mud. He turned his sopping shoes on and over the grate and dialed the thermostat higher. He made himself a bowl of granola and a cup of coffee and sat down at his old wooden kitchen table and ate mindlessly, then washed the dishes and put them in the drying rack. He'd have to go speak to Krishna. Well, have a good week. The next time you hear from me, I'll be in New York.